Dot com.
Anyone can make a change, the fear they have the will.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. Brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And Sansum Clinic, whose multi-specialty team of medical professionals have been providing quality care to you and your family for 98 years. And we're here today with Dr. Brad Boulay, a professor at UCSB in the History Department and a published author. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Neil, for inviting me to be here.
So, we were talking before the show, and I am very impressed that you are a former Penn State professor, because as some of our listeners know, one of the most, I think, greatest mystery writers of all time, Paul Levine, a resident of Santa Barbara, has indoctrinated me in the importance of being a Penn State football fan.
Yeah, I was that was my first job out of getting my PhD. I was 4 years at Penn State, and it was really a great experience. The football is amazing.
Did you go out for the team?
I tried. You know, they said I was too old. Actually, can you believe it? No, I mean, it was.
They said I was too old to do this radio show.
Yeah, right. Well, we're proving them wrong, right? We'll go put some pads on later.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. That's really not going to happen. So, you know, speaking of different career paths, you, and we'll talk about this at length, you know, you're in the history department. You have some very interesting expertise in areas that range from the Catholic Church to ancient Europe, medieval humanities. But you started off as a math and physics major.
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate at Cornell, and I finished there with a degree in math, but you can specialize in subfields. And my specialist was physics, actually. I even worked at the particle accelerator there. And I think, you know, how I got into that was sort of similar in a way that I got into how I got into history is I really thought of math and physics as sort of the search for the truth, right? You're going to find out what the real basics of the universe are. But after I was out for a little while, I started getting a little more – well, actually, I graduated and I was a ski bum for a year. I worked as a janitor at Jackson Hole. And my parents wouldn't let me do that unless I, like, you know, had something lined up afterwards, so I didn't just end up as a janitor. And I got into grad school for math. But the whole year I was a ski bum, I read a ton of history. It's just I got really excited about it. I was thinking, this is really kind of – if you want to know something about what it is to be human, this is much more connected with that than actually studying mathematics. And so then when I got to grad school in math, I was there one term, and I didn't like it. And I was going to leave. And they said, well, you know what? We'd have 5,000 students each year take calculus. So if you want to stick around, you're signed up to teach calculus. You can just take what you want while you figure it out. And I took a history class in the Renaissance from a really talented instructor. And that was sort of that. I was like lit on fire by it.
So this is very early in the show, but I'd like you to tell me about the meaning of life.
And that's because I haven't figured it out yet.
No, well, it sounds like you may be in a better position than I am, because you're both obviously an expert in math and physics, and yet some of your work that we're going to talk about involves the Catholic Church. You know, how likely is it that a scientist can actually have faith?
I mean, you know, that's a great question, especially because, you know, my father was a geologist. And he worked with actually a couple people who were actually had a lot of faith. And he asked them that exact question. He said, you know, how can you find all these fossils and still believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old? And they said it was a test, right? This is God testing us. But it's sort of an interesting thing that is coming up now, you know, in the last, you know, say 40 or 50 years in the United States, people think that you can't have both. But really, if you look, say, prior to 1950, a lot of people who were involved with studying the natural world thought their faith was part of it, right? Like, if you think of Galileo, it's like, oh, you know, this is a guy who was opposed to the church. If you look at what Galileo is doing when he's looking at the stars or any other, or when he's doing some of his mathematical experiments, he thinks of it as profoundly related to the faith. Like, he's exploring God's other book, the book of nature, right? So I think that one can be both faithful and a scientist even now, even if there are some things like the fact that Earth clearly is older than 6,000 years old that you have to reconcile with your faith. So
what do you teach a wide array of subjects? What does your course load look like?
Yeah, so at least humanities professor at UCSB has four courses a year they teach. And so I teach, as you sort of indicated in your introduction, my sort of temporal range is from about 1280 to 1800, mostly Europe. So I teach classes. I have a class on Machiavelli, Understanding Machiavelli, War, Women, and Politics. I have a class that I teach on just the, sort of the Renaissance in general, a class I'm going to be teaching on witchcraft, a class I'm going to be teaching on the historical events of witchcraft, a class I teach on the trial of Galileo. I've been working with there's a sort of a new program I know we're going to talk about in the medical humanities at Penn State, UCSB. Oh, my gosh, you got me thinking about Penn State. And so I teach some classes related to that. So I'm developing with a guy in the Evolution, Ecology, and Marine Biology Department, a class on the history of disease. And so we're going to look at it both as, you know, historical phenomena, like what happened when the Black Plague broke out, but also as a, you know, what is the science behind it?
When you talk about Machiavelli to the class, does anyone bring up current politics?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, so... it's 10 weeks, right? So I try to read most of Machiavelli's work. So that's like 4 or 5 weeks of the course. But the final few weeks are on, you know, sort of Machiavelli to now. And of course, people see a lot of, it depends a lot on your political divide, where you see the Machiavellian stuff being brought up. But like I had them read, you know, Ivanka Trump has this book, The Trump Card, right? And there's a section in there about perception and reality that really, really sounds like Machiavelli. And so,
well, I don't want to sound like an advertisement for the history, the study of history, but I don't see how you can navigate, you know, today's time. I'm not talking about history repeats itself. I'm just talking about understanding how people think and how they make decisions. You have to understand human nature. And that basically is the roadmap for that is history.
No, I mean, I agree completely. And I would add to that. I mean, I think, first of all, humans haven't changed in their sort of fundamental makeup in several thousand years, right? Like 200,000 years or something like that. And so how people reacted to things in the past is a good way to think about how people are reacting now. But I think beyond that, if you look at current American politics, both sides of Democrats, Republicans, people far to the left, far to the right, are using history as part of their arguments one way or another. That we should do this with migrants or we should do that. And they base it very much on, well, this is what happened in the past when we did this or that in American politics. And some people are very careful about how they use the history and others are not. And they're using it specifically for, making a point rather than being accurate.
When I heard you were going to be on the show, I looked you up in my professor ratings because I used to teach and I have good ratings and you have as good a rating as I do. You had a perfect score. So you've made quite a name for yourself in a very short period of time in a very tough audience.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I think the sample size is kind of small so far. And I can be honest, I also looked myself up on there. I think you got like 3 or 4 people who are saying very positive things, which is nice. But I think, you know, that there's sort of an issue with people go on there for one of two reasons. Either they loved you and want to say something about how great you were, or they hated you and they wanted to make it known how awful you were. And so
I noticed I haven't taught since 2013, and I think, unless I missed it, they changed the system where part of it used to be how good looking you were.
Yeah, you can't get a chili pepper anymore, right?
Right. So I was disappointed. I got great grades as a teacher, but I was kind of not perfect as someone who is hot, and I guess they've relieved professors from having to deal with looks.
Yeah, I mean, it's
part of the Me Too movement, probably.
It is funny because, like, you know, I not to sound vain, but like, yeah, I did the same thing. And like, when I was in it, so they, I don't know when they removed that feature, but it was definitely after I was teaching. And I remember seeing friends of mine who had chili peppers, like, oh man, I didn't get a chili pepper. Yeah.
You're a tenure track professor at UCSB, which is really a big deal today. It's really, you know, particularly coming from humanities. It's really hard if you look at a list of professions, the lowest chance of making money and being successful is besides art history or something in that area. So you chose a field that's, you know, obviously you've succeeded at it, but has a very, it's like being, you want to be a professional baseball player, same kind of percentage of success.
No, I know. It was a matter of stress for a good decade in my life, right? Like, have I done something, especially graduated with a degree in math, the earning potential on that is quite high. There's all sorts of fields you can go into that are very applied. And instead of doing that, I decided to go back to graduate school in history and like dramatically decrease my possibilities of earning potential.
And increase your debt.
And increase my debt. Well, no, normally if you go into a PhD program, it's paid for these days. But like, it certainly didn't save any money during those graduate school years, right? And I guess, I mean, my thought about it was, I think about my dad. You know, he was a geologist, and he did what he loved, despite the fact that, you know, geologists don't make a ton of money either. And, you know, he was a very happy person. And so I think to myself, that's what I want to be. And I was realizing that's not what I was having in my life. And so I was sort of very idealistic about it. It's like, I'm going to go back and do what I want to do. I'm going to bet on myself. Maybe not that many people make it, but I'm going to make it. And then I guess the sort of the last thing I thought to myself, well, if it just doesn't end up in me being a professor, I'm not going to feel this is wasted time, because I got to spend my 20s and early 30s studying something I really love and that I thought was, you know, sort of worthwhile just in general. And so it was nice for me. But I feel extremely lucky that it's worked out that I've been professor at two institutions so far. So,
you know, that's a really good point you bring up about humanities, and it's unfortunate that people are looking at ranking education opportunities based on what it is that what your prospects are for making money. But to be, you know, a Renaissance man or woman, you really need to understand literature and you need to understand art. And one of the problems in this country is people understand coding, but they don't really understand. So I'm going to leave it at that. We have to take a break. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Brad Boulay, author and UCSB professor of history. And right before the break, we were talking about the value of humanities, and UCSB has a new program called Engaging Humanities.
Yeah, that's right. So this is at several universities. It's funded by the Mellon Foundation, right? And so one of the things directly relates to what we were talking about right before the break, this perception that humanities majors are not profitable. And actually, statistics don't back that up. Statistics point out that history majors, English majors, they have, first of all, just as much of a chance of getting hired as business majors, if not better. And if you look at sort of long-term profitability, humanities careers are actually more profitable. People who are majoring in humanities then go off to a career than most business majors, actually. So the perception that it's not worthwhile is actually inaccurate. But beyond that, we have to get people interested in actually majoring in humanities at a variety of universities, including UCSB. So this program has come about both to convince people that it's profitable, but to get people excited about it. So they've what they've done is ended up partnering a bunch of professors from various fields to teach sort of these classes that both motivate student interest and help train them for the market. So the one I taught this summer was with a fellow in rhetoric and English, and we taught a class. It was called The Self Before Selfies, and it looked at sort of how people identified who they were beginning in the Renaissance up through the 20th century. And so part of it's this sort of historical, like looking at how people historically define themselves, but also genre, how are people putting themselves forward in text. But then also the students were required to create CVs in the classes and then create websites that were professional in nature. So defining who they were while thinking also about how people define themselves in the past and how has it changed. So it's sort of both things, right? It's professionalism tied with humanities, with thinking about the self in the past. So
That's encouraging because I understand that many, even some of the top MBA schools are losing students because not only, forget about humanities, people don't even want an MBA degree anymore because they want to get on to finding the best new app. And so, the smartest and brightest, instead of sitting around, discussing the meaning of life, they're discussing, how to, shop and get the best price on the internet. So we sort of like motivated people by income stream to do things that are really probably not as helpful to humanity as we would like.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like depending on what you do in technology, it can seem like a get-rich-quick way to go about it, right? If you develop the right app, you can get rich very, very rapidly,
So this program, Engaging Humanities, is it oriented towards freshmen so you can get people to begin?
Absolutely. So it's freshmen and transfers, right? So it basically the way that it works, and it's run in part by the CITRAL, Center for Innovative Teaching, I think Research and Learning at UCSB. And so what the people at CITRAL have done, in particular Dr. Adler Kastner, is they have identified people on their freshman applications or on their transfers said that they're interested in studying the humanities. Like, you list a prospective major and some people list a couple, and they basically ask these people if they want to be involved with this. And what you get in addition to these classes that you get preferred enrollment in is you get a mentor. So they'll have people who are available to talk to you, not just about your career path or whatever, but about, what classes should I take, or beyond your advisor, right? Like what should I be getting involved with? What should I do to feel like I'm getting a better education or a better experience here? Which especially at large universities, I think a lot of students feel lost. And so this is a very good way both to promote the humanities, but provide a resource for people who are going into that field.
What I find also is that when you teach in a collaborative way across various specialties, the student really gets a better understanding of the world as it was then. And I remember in my senior year of college, I took a course that for the first time, and this was a long time ago, but it was a history course, and it didn't just deal with dates. It was basically the social aspects of the whole period, and so it took into effect economics, it took into effect voting rights and women's rights, and all of a sudden a light bulb. It's a little bit late for me at my senior year, a light bulb. But this is a good way to teach or learn.
Yeah, well, I think in general, these days, most history professors approach it that way. Like, let's have sort of like, the cultural, politics, all of that going together, intellectual. But then, to your point about someone else in the room, even if I'm trying to present it with that broad point of view, having someone else in there from a different discipline is like, oh, and don't forget about this issue, or, oh, that's not how I read that. I read it like this. I heard later from students that was the most exciting part of the class for them when this other professor and we were friends, so we didn't really disagree, but we'd be like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't think of it that way. And for them, that was really the moment that they started, oh, okay, there's different perspectives. It's not just canon being delivered. It's sort of how do we make sense of what's going on in the past.
Which goes along with, not to get back, because you told me to get back to your ratings, but one of the comments that somebody said was that you're a good storyteller. And storytelling is a really good way to teach because it gives somebody a way of intuitively understanding something. When you say in 1842 the battle, people's eyes glaze over. But if you can find a way of doing it with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a sort of a series of interesting activities, it makes it more likely someone's going to actually get something from it.
No, I feel exactly the same way. I mean, what drew me to history, I sort of said this very theoretical thing about being interested in truth or whatever, but it's the stories of the human experience, right? I feel like the past really comes alive, at least for me, in sort of two moments. One, where you see something in the past, you're like, that's insane. That's nothing like now, which is basically what both of my books are about. Or that you're reading something, you're like, that's just like now. I remember that year when I was a ski bum, I read Marcus Aurelius, you know, this emperor in the 2nd century AD, his meditations, and some of the stuff he was worried about. This is one of the most powerful people in the world 1,800 years ago. And some of the stuff he's concerned about is exactly what I was concerned about. Like, oh, this person was saying bad things about me or whatnot. And so, yeah.
Was he a skier also?
Probably, yeah. He had a lot of campaigns north of the Rhine. It was probably pretty cold. And
So you know, the history department is attempting to engage with the wider community. Is this part of it? This whole part of the Engaging Humanities is all part of the whole UCSB effort?
Well, it's interesting. It's actually separate. The Engaging Humanities is a separate program which involves people in the history department. But I think the history department for several years has been pretty good about trying to reach out to the wider community. So last year, we have two-year themes in the history department. So last year and the year before, the theme was migrations, which is very topical right now. But there was a series of films that were put on, both on campus but for the wider community, that then had professors both from UCSB and people invited in to talk about them, and in particular their importance right now. So this was something that engaged people. This year, the theme is gender and politics. And this is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the United States. So there's a whole series of events that are going to be related to that, that talk about the way that gender has informed politics and is being informed by politics right now in the United States. And I don't think I need to even talk about for contemporary events for people to immediately think about how important gender has been. So.
Well, is it? But it's okay for a woman to be president now, do you think?
I hope so.
You hope
yeah.
so? I think we better take a break. Yeah. You're listening to AHA Presents A Bad Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Brad Boulay, author and UCSB professor in the Department of History, although saying the Department of History kind of limits what he does. And what I'd like to talk about now is one of your books. Now, can I pronounce this? Is it Pious Postmortems?
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, so this is a book that probably most people wouldn't just ordinarily just pick up, but it's a really fascinating subject. Let's begin to try to unfold it.
Yeah, I mean, so we were talking before the break about history being most exciting when things are really weird or really like now. And I was reading for my PhD exams, and I found that in 1595, there was this guy who was up for being a saint. His name was Filippo Neri. And it's part of his canonization process, because you get canonized. It's kind of like a trial. They have to, you know, make sure your miracles are real and whatnot. They cut him open. They sliced open his body to see, like...
Before he was dead?
He was dead. He was dead. Sorry. Post-mortem. Post-mortem. Yeah, yeah, sorry. I should have included that point.
I mean, it's a very painful way to become a saint.
Yeah, yeah. So
but it may be worth it. It may be worth it.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, if you could be God's right hand. But no, so he died. I should rephrase it. He died, and then, like, a couple nights after he died, they brought in the physicians, and they cut him open to see where God had touched him. The idea being that, you know, this whole idea that we have that, oh, maybe spirit is something outside your body or something different from, that's not how people thought in the 16th and 17th centuries. What they thought is that if God is going to touch your spirit, it's definitely going to be visible somehow in your body. Your spirit and body are intertwined. And so with Neri, for example, they found that his heart was like wondrously oversized. His left ventricle was oddly large. His pulmonary artery, and keep in mind, this is the moment where pulmonary transit is being discovered, was strangely large. There was all this sort of, his ribs were turned upwards as if like a bomb had gone off in his heart. And all of this was sort of interpreted by these really top medical practitioners, people who are involved with figuring out pulmonary transit, as signs that, you know, this can't possibly be natural. This must be that God has touched him. Anyway, so this is what got me into it, this crazy story. And I was like, what the hell? What are they doing? And so I started looking for more of these cases. And I got a grant, so I ended up going to the Vatican. And while I was at the Vatican archives, I found about 40 other cases where they performed postmortem autopsies on prospective saints to see if God had touched them, which – and that only stopped at 40 because, you know, time sort of ran out. I just couldn't keep looking at this. You know, there were this many cases, though, just between like about 1550 and 1650. And although this sounds like insanity, like what are they doing? They're cutting open saints to see what made them holy. It's sort of related to a couple bigger issues. I mean, first of all, you know, the church doesn't canonize anyone for 65 years after the Reformation. This is the longest break they had in saint making, really, since they started making saints. So clearly there was a moment they're like, oh crap, really, should we be thinking that people are holy in this way? And when they reassert the cult of the saints, when they start saying again, no, there's really our saints out there, they're trying to prove it somehow, be like, you know, really try to prove miracles. Say like, no, these people, you know, have real miracles. They've really done things up outside the bounds of nature. And so they partner, at least for 100 years, with another burgeoning field. It's right at this moment that Andreas Vesalius is publishing his book, like On the Fabric of the Human Body, that we have really sort of start getting very accurate anatomical manuals. And so these guys are sort of brought in, like, what do you think? Could this be supernatural? And these people do indeed, for the most part, and there are some cases where it doesn't work out, but they do indeed say, like, yeah, I think that this body you see here is so outside the realm of normal that something supernatural is going on. So you have this partnership between early science and religion.
But as a 16th century medical professional could be looking at something that's just disease and say that's abnormal as a positive.
Yeah, so you raise a good point, right? Like, why? First of all, why did they think that they had sort of the range of medical knowledge that they could, you know, pronounce definitively, like, ah, this must be outside the bounds of the natural? And I think, you know, looking back 500 years ago, we think to ourselves, wow, they were so limited, their range of medical ability. But each generation, I think, thinks that way. Like, we think we know so much now, but it's like in 500 years, people probably look back and say, oh my gosh, they knew nothing, you know, comparatively. So there's that aspect. It tells us something about you know, what people thought about medicine. It's not they didn't think it was backwards. They thought it was like really progressive and really could tell something about nature. But then also, it's true, there has been physicians who've gone back and looked at some of these cases and said, oh, okay, this person was clearly just suffering from X, Y, or Z. But then there's others that don't map on to modern cases. So Filippo Neri, who I already mentioned, there's been multiple attempts to go back and re-diagnose what was actually going on in his heart, because we have extensive descriptions. There's like, you know, 5-10 pages that go on about what's going on in there. And the most recent report said, well, he must have suffered from these 7 or 8 extremely abnormal cardiac conditions to end up with a heart like that. It's like, okay, basically what you're saying is that even modern medical science doesn't have a definition of what was going on there, which leaves you with, I mean, what I think is that what these people were seeing in his heart, they aren't describing it in the same terms that we are. I'm not saying like a miracle occurred or anything like that. I'm saying, though, that their view of the human body was very, even though they're medical practitioners, was very different than how we understand the workings of the body now. So in some ways, it's not one-to-one. You can't read 16th century medical descriptions and then back diagnose. It's very problematic to do.
So this story you just told us is part of the book, but let's step back and look from an overview. What's the book about?
So the book is sort of looking at these 40 cases and talking about, okay, so there's this moment where the church was trying to prove sanctity. How do they go about that? They enlisted medical professionals. So this idea, this pervasive idea that religion and science are at odds, at times they are at odds in this period, Galileo very notably. But at other times, they're working together. So it's called the complexity thesis for the history of science.
Okay, so excuse, let me interrupt then. You said they, this is something they wanted to do. If faith is what you need to be a good religious person, why did they need to do this?
Yeah, right. I mean, so because you think about it now, if you're really very faithful, so we just kind of believe, you know, it doesn't matter.
So what motivated them to do a science? It's interesting. It's kind of flipped around. 500 years from then, maybe you could see them doing it today.
Yeah. So why? Yeah. Why would they be looking for proof? Because it seems like that's the antithesis of faith, right? Faith is not proof. Right. It's about believing in the absence of proof in many ways, right? So why are they trying to prove it? And I think they're reacting to several things happening at that moment. I mean, first of all, you have to think about the effect the Reformation had, right? I mean, so I said they paused saint making for 65 years, but just generally in society, here the Catholic Church had been, in many ways, the glue of society for over 1,000 years. Your parishes had been established by 800 AD in a lot of places. Your parish priest, there was a lot of continuity. Your whole calendar was ordained, was set up by, you know, feast and fast, these sorts of things. I mean, if you look at timekeeping in this period, even people talk about, oh, it's the amount of time to say this many Our Fathers, or it's the amount of time to do this. It's always this saint's day rather than like the 15th of September. So all of life was sort of dictated in many ways by religion, or at least even if you're not super faithful, but like the religious background of your culture. And here we have a moment where it's shattered, right? In the course of really 20 years between, you know, 1517 with the nailing of the 95 Theses to the 1540s, you have multiple denominations, people saying that the books should be read in very different ways. God interacts with people in very different ways. And the Catholic Church, I think, is both reeling from this and attempting to demonstrate that they're the correct ones, that we got it right. And at that same moment, the 16th century is also really the period in which empiricism, early experimental method, this is all beginning to take place. And so the church is looking at people who are demonstrating that unusual phenomena are taking place, like, oh, I really saw the moons around Jupiter. Oh, I really saw this in the human body. And they're using those techniques. These people are able to prove that you know, that this unusual phenomenon has happened and people were really believing them. Let's adopt those techniques. Let's use those techniques for our unusual phenomena.
So part of it was almost defensive.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of it is that, you know, it's hard when you talk about Catholic reform efforts here. There's some that is defensive, a lot that's defensive, you know, reeling from these attacks. But then there's other parts of it that are sort of already going on in the background. There had been a little bit in the 14th and 15th centuries of trying to use a medicine to prove holiness, but it had been overwhelmingly for women. So there are cases in the 14th century of sort of autopsy to a different extent, but it's all women.
So what led you to look at the Catholic Church as opposed to the other side of the, you know, the Catholic Church was the defenders here. And then there's, you know, the offense.
Well, because the Protestants aren't doing this in a systematic way, right? I mean, Protestants don't believe in saints at all, even if there are some people who are recognized as holy. I mean, Luther, for example, is treated saint-like by some Lutherans in the 16th century after his death. But there's no sort of systematic way of doing that like there is in the church. The Catholic Church has a congregation which is dedicated to canonizing saints. They collect this evidence. They're trying to prove that these people are beyond the bounds of the human. So there's like a documentary body of evidence that's available to look at. And I have found that there are debates over certain Protestant bodies. Luther, for example, we're pretty sure he died of stroke. That's not actually a very holy way to die, right? Because if you have stroke, sometimes you're still alive for a little while, so you can't really, you know, say any profound last words or anything like that. Maybe your speech is impaired, these sorts of things. So there's a lot of debate over how he died. But for other sort of Protestant reformers, there's not not the sort of same comprehensive grouping like that, and there's not like a general program. Like I have found canon lawyers, people who are part of canonization of the church, saying, yes, this is something we should do. So there's a real program with the Catholic Church that I can look at then.
Why is this subject and this course taught in the history department? Shouldn't this be in religion?
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at this book and where it was reviewed, and I haven't taught a course on my book because that seems a little vain to be like, everyone should buy my book, and we'll talk about it. But as much of that might
be good. By the way, while we're on it, how would one buy this
book? It's available on Amazon.
Okay, and it's Pious Postmortems, and actually, because people listening probably can't spell either of those words, you just look under Dr. Brad Bouley, Bouley.
Yeah, I haven't published that widely yet in my career. So if you search my name, you'll find that and then a translation of another book I did. So, yeah, it should be pretty easy. I forgot what we were saying, how we got to that point, though. You're saying why should this be history rather than religion? I mean, it has a lot to say also about religion, right? But the debates, and so when the book was reviewed, it was reviewed in sort of some history journals, some history of science journals, and some religious journals. So I think it has a lot to say about religion as well. But I'm not really engaging in arguments about sort of the meaning of theology or anything like that. I'm documenting a historical phenomenon that lasted really 150 years and talking about its origins, why it came about, how it was, you know, enacted, and then sort of why it comes to an end.
So your next work is not going to be about religion.
It is in a way, because I'm talking in a similar way about what happens with food in Rome and especially the Eucharist and ideas about cannibalism in the same period.
Hold that thought. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Brad Boulay, author and UCSB professor in the Department of History. And we were just discussing his book, Pious Postmortems, we were looking forward to what his next work is. So what is the next book's about?
Well, so it's called The Barberini Butchers, Meat, Murder, and Warfare in Early Modern Italy.
Oh, good. It's a murder story.
It's a murder story. Yeah, actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to tell another story of how I came to it. So actually, while I was doing research in the Vatican for the last book, I was going through, the newspapers are really born in the 16th century, although they're mostly handwritten, right? And I found one in the early 17th century that said, okay, Rome gets laid siege to during this minor war, the War of the Castro in the 1640s. And it said, okay, during the course of this war, these four butchers, it's what's called a justice narrative. This is like early modern law and order. So it's a whole series of stories that people would buy where it says like, oh, there was this crime that was committed. We didn't know who did it. This hero finds out who did it, and then they're executed at the end. Normally they're issued by the government. Like
So this is not fiction. These are actual.
Well, so this is the good – that's a great question because I'm going through these because I'm looking for something about the saint. And I find this one that says these four butchers during the siege killed seven of their fellow Roman citizens, ground them with pork sausage, and then sold them to Romans from their shop behind the Pantheon. And it was crazy. And there's a huge amount of details. So you talk about manuscripts, you talk about folio, big folio pages. And so there's 15 pages. There's a wealth of detail. And a lot of these other cases were indeed fact. Like they'd been taken from published by the Vatican on cases that were really there. And this one was so incredible, and I'd never heard anything about it, and I'm an expert on this period. So I was like, why haven't I heard this? So I And then I found several copies of it. Like I found like three or four handwritten copies, which in for the 17th century, for there to be three or – so it's, I have four right now. For there to be four copies of one handwritten manuscript in several different collections, that means that it was circulating. People were correcting it, collecting it. Like I found one in England. I found a couple in the Vatican, one in Florence. So it's like, okay, this was a news story that had some legs. So I was like, I need to find out if this happened. So I spent a few months, you know, trying to hunt this down. And it turns out it probably didn't happen, that it's actually – it's fiction, and fiction that's like satire. It's actually aimed at the papacy. And because then there's all this stuff in there that like this happened because Romans got so used to eating so much meat that when their meat ran out, they were willing to go as anywhere they needed to get meat. So we were willing to eat humans and with like maybe knowing that it was going on. And I was like, no, that can't be true either. They weren't eating that much meat in the period. So I'll go to verify that. And I found actually indeed between about 1580 and 1640, the amount of meat Romans ate about – quintuple, five times bigger. It expanded massively and rapidly over the course of about 50 years. And so then that sort of became the project. Like, how did they do that? Why did they do that? What meats are they eating? Like, this is not dietary advice at the time. So what are people saying about this in Rome? And so sort of that became the project. It's sort of two things, like this kind of strange narrative that I think will become an article of the cannibal butchers, but then the bigger project of why are Romans eating so much meat in this period? And then if you know anything about Rome now, Roman culture, Roman culinary culture is not actually super meat heavy. It's actually a lot of offal because they didn't have good cuts of meat. So how did it change so dramatically from 1640s when they're eating, you know, a lot of beef, actually, and a lot of lamb, to that's not really a part of Roman diet, you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries. So that's what the book's about, sort of figuring out what's going on with that.
And the are there lessons though about that we could take for what we're facing today? I mean, I could think of a theory right now with they having trouble with agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's absolutely an environmental history lesson to it, right? I mean, if you know the sort of the countryside around Rome, Lazio, that's not a very productive actually countryside, and so. You know, of course, they had different animal husbandry techniques, different ways of using the land. But basically what they did is they totally overpopulated with animals. In this course of this 50 years to try to massively supply animal product to Rome, they quite clearly destroyed a lot of resources, actually. So after this moment of – and they – you can think of it. They almost sort of brought the resources to this finely balanced point, and this minor conflict so sort of threw off supply lines that they weren't able to recover. Like by even the early 20th century – the amount of meat being consumed in Rome is nowhere near what it was in 1640. It's really, you know, the industrialized agriculture in the 20th century that's able to bring it sort of back to that level.
Let me suggest a final chapter for this book.
Lay it on me.
How about this? Because this makes it a bestseller.
All right.
Okay.
Lay it on me.
Okay. So here we have America, which is the Rome of today. You know, quite clearly the most powerful. And what was Rome's – Rome had 500 years? How many years did it have?
Well, ancient Rome was – you really say 753 BC to like 476 AD are the kind of the canonical days. But if you talk about them like ruling the world really from around Caesar, right, from the, you know, okay. Early BCs.
Okay. So, you know, the question is where does America fit in and what are the lessons? I mean, no one thought back then that Rome was going to tank as it did. So are there – you know, we talk about history having lessons that we can give. What can we give America? From your study of...
From my study of Rome in this period, I eat less meat.
Okay. Right? Well, thank you for being here today.
No, I mean, I think that there is sort of an environmental history aspect of like, gee, you need to really be careful about how you're managing your resources and not just sort of enrich consumers in a way that makes you feel good about like, ah, yes, we're all benefiting from this. Mm-hmm. But also, the argument that I make, or starting to make in the book, is that It's popes who are indeed, again, reacting to the Reformation and trying to argue that, like, you know, Rome had sort of been taken as an emblem of the decadence of the church, right? Martin Luther and John Calvin, all sorts of these reformers write about, like, oh, I went to Rome. It is a city sunk in sin. You can see what's going on there. And there's numerous efforts on the part of many popes, beginning really in the 1540s, to challenge that image, right? And one of the ways they try to challenge it is, look, no. If you come to Rome, it's not just about fasting. When the days that you eat meat, you get a lot of meat. It's okay. It's good to be a Roman citizen, these sorts of things. But that's really a very short-sighted policy, right? You're trying to basically – you're enacting the goals of a certain regime that's trying to make the citizens happy for its own sort of agenda, right? And so I think being aware of
– Yeah, but what's really interesting, can you imagine a debate now thinking of John Calvin against the Pope? I mean, here, think about it in today's context. I mean, who's more right-wing? I mean, it's like
– Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, if you look at – I teach a class on the Reformation at UCSB, and it's kind of wonderful for me, and because these students will – a lot of students take the class to find their own sort of confessional backgrounds, and they think that they know who Luther is or they know who Calvin is, and then they really read about him in historical context. It's like, no, all of these guys by modern standards would have been extremely religious conservative, you know? I mean, Luther writes about, like, you know, peasants who are above their status, the thieving, murderous hordes of peasants, or, like, you know, various other religious minorities as not being, you know, Jews, he writes very negatively about. And so these are not –
What was their view on witchcraft?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, all of – so – there's a passage in Exodus that was I mean, all these guys are preaching biblical literalism at this point, right? And there's a passage in Exodus that depends on how you translate it, can be translated as, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And so there's a real emphasis on witch hunting in the 16th century, both Catholic and Protestant. And I'm glad you brought this up, because actually on Halloween, the history department, I will be giving a lecture that's available to the public, but on UCSB campus, about the history of what they call the Great Witch Hunt. Because
what are you going to wear?
I actually do have a costume,
oh, okay.
But I don't want to tell
okay.
you.
Okay.
But I mean, between 1450 and 1700, the bottom figure that we're absolutely sure this many people are prosecuted were 50,000. The high number is 100,000. We think it might have been as high as 100,000 people charged with witchcraft, which between about 30 and 50% actually being convicted and then executed. And so if you think, like I do, that witchcraft is not real, that people can't actually cast spells, you have, by definition, at least 50,000 people in early modern Europe who were falsely accused, if not 100,000. So if they can't possibly commit this crime, how are they imagining that this is going on? And so this is what I'm going to talk about. Like, why does it – and it's only – the other thing to say is this is sort of unique, although – It is unique. All periods, all cultures pretty much have some belief in magic before the modern era. It is only in Europe at this moment that we have tens of thousands of trials for people practicing magic. So why? What's happening right now that makes this happen?
Well, but that's because they had trials. In other cultures, they just didn't bother to have a trial.
But there's not systematic – it's true that there are other cultures where people are executed for bad magic, but they're not systematically persecuted in this way, right? I mean, you have – it's not just that there's trials. There's like widespread belief across Europe in both Protestant and Catholic countries, in England, in Russia, in Italy – everywhere, at least it's part of – kind of.
Is that because people feel threatened when they have a belief system that's so strong that when they begin to hear things that aren't consistent with it, they can't tolerate it? Is that sort of like a human nature to fight it?
I think that's part of it, right? I think that what I would argue – and there's – keep in mind, this is an open question. So there's a lot of people who debate like why the witch hunts occur. I think it has a lot to do with the Reformation. Like if you look at temporally when they start breaking out, it's when you get this sort of religious diversity. And so there's this concern that like – really a concern about evil. You have people talking about Satan walking abroad and he has been unleashed from his pit, and that's why we have religious diversity. And his minions must be out there. And so there's this pervasive belief that he's around, like Satan, and so his minions are there. But also in addition to that – I would say it comes also out of a logic tradition in the West. The universities are, of course, founded in the West in the 12th and 13th centuries, and they have a specific way of arguing. It's really a very logic-based thing. And they debate all sorts of things, actually, that we'd be shocked that they debate, whether God exists, whether life is eternal, these sorts of things. But one of the things they debate is, where does this magic come from? And the conclusion they come to in the universities is, well, God does miracles, which is clearly supernatural, but that's not magic. And man can't do magic or wouldn't be magical. It'd be something, you know, that is natural. So it must come from somewhere else. Well, the only other option is Satan, right? So even things that seem to be white magic, like, you know, love spells or healing magic, it gets labeled as evil in this period because even if you think you're not doing something bad, you're secretly conjuring the devil. And so it's, I think, an intellectual process that aligns any sort of spell casting with Satan. It's a deep concern that Satan must be everywhere. That's why we're getting the Reformation. And then it's, yeah, I think this reaction to hearing and seeing diverse viewpoints, right? Because another aspect that happens in the Reformation is widespread migration, right?
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB. And we'll be right back with our final segment.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Sansom Clinic, we're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Brad Boulay, author and UCSB professor in the Department of History. I have to ask you, you know, we talked about witchcraft. The political discourse in this country, which has gone down the tubes, people are now saying it's a witch hunt.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? You know, it's they're using that as sort of a way of saying, you know, you're not listening to me, or you're dismissing me, or you're attacking me for no reason.
Well, I think, you know, in the United States, we have a long history of believing in conspiracies, right? You can think about the 19th century, all of the concerns about Freemasonry. Of course, everyone thinks about McCarthyism in the 1950s. And even going back further, the Salem witch trials, right? And so there's a long history of believing in this country that there is some sort of outside group that's secretly trying to work their agenda. And you can see that, of course, right now, with deep state theorists and things like that. And then the accusation of witchcraft, or not witchcraft, but of being a witch hunt, it's something that calls up such a, oh, what a ridiculous thing that you're saying. That it's sort of like saying someone's acting like Hitler or a Nazi. It's one of these rhetoric phrases, that rhetorical phrases that immediately cast the opposition in such a negative light. But the reality is it's something that has been – almost every generation has to confront some sort of hysteria like this.
So we'll, in 1 minute, tell us what a certificate in medical humanities is.
Right. So there's this among the many wonderful things UCSB is doing right now, one of the things is to be partnering with our wonderful medical community here to offer people who are thinking about going into the medical field a background in humanities to be relevant for their profession, because there's been a huge amount of evidence that medical practitioners become better practitioners if they have more exposure to humanities. And what I mean by better is, of course, better bedside, but also better resiliency, that some sort of training in the humanities allow these people who are, you know, in the ERs or in you know, high-risk surgeries, actually, or oncologists, to be better able to themselves to keep coming back to the job. So we're trying to give people a background on that. Also, it seems that it helps people from medical school to get in.
Okay, so a certificate, that means anyone could...
Anyone
can go. So this conversation actually has been terrific. And am I too old to go to your audit your class? How old? What's the age group?
No, there's no age limit. You can always audit.
Well, thank you so much. Sounds the kids, if that's the right term, at UCSB are lucky to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And thank you all for listening to About Education. And we'll see you next week.